Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Introducing Rob Prince. He is the publisher of Colorado Progressive Jewish News. And you might remember I've interviewed him before on the issue of America / Ethiopia, etc. war against Somalia, which has really been going on since the very early part of this century. And interviewed him before about this article in Foreign Policy in Focus. WikiLeaks reveals U.S. twisted Ethiopia's arm to invade Somalia in what appears to be another U.S. proxy war. Welcome back to the show, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good, Scott. I would only add that the Colorado Progressive Jewish News has now morphed into, for the last year or so, into what is now Views from Left Field, as I call it. It died a peaceful death. And nothing wrong with that, because today there are really a whole slew of progressive Jewish voices. At the time that it began, there were far fewer. It's fine. Anyhow, let's go on. I did want to make that initial point.
Sure, and that's right. You say Views from Left Field, correct?
That's right, yes. Okay. Well, it's my views.
Sure.
Occasionally there's somebody else, but mostly it's my views, and it's mostly articles that articles or talks. So the articles appear in Foreign Policy in Focus. There's a Tunisian human rights website called Nawat, NAWAAT.org. It's actually it's won major awards. I write for them too. And on occasion, I write for another publication, which is, you really should look into. It's called Algeria Watch. Nawat and Algeria Watch, they have articles in different languages, but the stuff in English is as good as it gets in terms of North Africa. And you don't see much that's really good in English on North Africa, that's solid, that's progressive, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so I write for them, and I just had a couple pieces that have appeared. And on occasion, my stuff does appear in Counterpunch. I had a piece there a couple weeks ago.
All right,
so that's who I write for, and then I put it, you know, I basically just put it on the same stuff on the blog.
All right, cool.
Okay. All right.
So now back to Somalia.
I
think, well, we kind of need to start this interview with a correction, unfortunately,
correct.
But I think it's all right. I went hunting for the WikiLeaks in question here, and I couldn't find it, Rob.
That's right, and neither could I. The original source of it was an article from a publication called the Sudan Times, which referred to a WikiLeaks piece. And so that was my original source. And in looking over the WikiLeaks material, I couldn't find it. Now, I might add that, you know, if you go to WikiLeaks and you go to a country, Somalia or Ethiopia, what comes up is, you know, 10,000 communications.
Right.
I've actually gone through a fair number of them, but I haven't found it either. And so for that, you know, I should have followed up on that at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. And the thing of it is that mm-hmm. it was quite a credible piece of propaganda when they say WikiLeaks reveals what we already know, basically. And I guess there is a question of just mm-hmm. how much America twisted Ethiopia's arm, but there's no question, even from the very beginning, even in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that this invasion, the Ethiopian army was accompanied by the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command in the entire thing. I mean, that's the official version of the invasion of Christmas 2006.
You know, yes. If you look, in preparation, actually, for this interview, I started rereading stuff on Somalia. And, of course, there's not a lot, but there is some good stuff. And I would recommend it to people who are interested in this. I don't have a Bible, but as close as it gets on these secret wars is Jeremy Scahill's Dirty Wars and the sections on that in on Somalia. And there was also a recent piece that appeared, I think it was a week ago or something like that. Oh, no, more recently than that. No, I'm sorry. This one is from Foreign Policy, July 2nd, 2015, by Ty McCormick, exclusive. U.S. operates drones from secret bases in Somalia. And then some articles that appear at the Global Research, the Canadian site. I keep hearing, kind of nasty comments about that site, but I want to tell you the stuff that I've seen is quite good. It's solid. So if you look, if you kind of put all these pieces together, what emerges is starting with the policies that were enacted in the early 1990s up until Black Hawk Down, the Black Hawk Down incident, 1991 to 1994. And in that period, what you'll see is that as the United States moves into Somalia, it begins to set up a pattern. And that's more or less the same pattern that we see in Afghanistan, quite frankly, in Iraq, in many places. And that is, with whom is it that the U.S. Military, and here we're talking about, well, CIA, JSOC, these kind of forces, who are they working with? They're working with warlords and actually shunting aside, if you like, the legitimate or semi-legitimate governments in these places. The reason they give for working with warlords is that the warlords can deal with the Islamic terrorists. In so doing, what they tend to do, what they have done in Afghanistan and here and in Somalia, is to strengthen the position of the warlords. The warlords have gone after some Islamic terrorists, but they've gone after everybody else as well, i.e. Legitimate elements. So that's what we did, created a mess up till 1994. Then we leave after Black Hawk Down, or drop it, more or less the same way we left Afghanistan, with a very similar result. The country basically continues in a state of collapse. We have warlord factions fighting with one another. Then U.S. attention rivets after 9/11, first on Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's only in 2005 and 2006 that the United States once again gives its attention to Somalia. I would add here, and if I'm going on too long, cut into me, but the essence of U.S. policy in Somalia is basically geostrategic. If you look at a map, and you look at the northern regions of Somalia, you'll see that Somalia juts on the southern part of what's called the Gulf of Aden, which leads to a choke point, one of what's considered one of the eight important strategic choke points as defined by the U.S. Department of Defense in the world, and it's called the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Just north of the Somali border is this little enclave, French enclave, Djibouti, and there the United States has its what one today would call its acknowledged U.S. military base in Africa. Then there are all the unacknowledged ones. Camp Limonier, which is a very, very important place. So basically, the situation in Somalia, U.S. interest in Somalia, from what I could tell, has more to do with controlling the sea routes, in which a great deal of oil and natural gas and other things flow, and controlling access to the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. In any case, getting back to the story, 2006, the situation in Somalia has completely deteriorated. Well, how to deal with Somalia? Well, we're dealing with Somalia according to a model that I was talking about it last night on another show. I refer to it as the Obama Doctrine. And now it's being applied to the Middle East. You use your proxies, so whether it's Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Israel, whatever, to do most of the fighting while you try to control, you know, from the kind of the back, so to speak, the overall political direction of what's happening. All right. Well, that actually started in Africa much earlier. And there are certain key players in Somalia. Ethiopia is definitely one. Kenya, Uganda, very, very important player, much more important than people realize in Somalia. And here, you know, the idea over the years, what had happened because of the complete breakdown of Somali society, which at least in part, in large measure, as far as from what I can tell, is a result of the U.S. supporting these warlords. Well, the warlords, warlords are warlords. They're just, you know, thugs. And so the situation seriously deteriorated in Somalia to such a degree. And it was in that deteriorated socioeconomic situation that Al-Shabaab, that actually emerges from what are referred to as Islamic courts, and they have a long history in Somalia, it emerges as a kind of indigenous counterforce. So to stop Al-Shabaab, to stop the growth of Al-Shabaab, which at one point controlled either different, I've seen different statistics, but anywhere from 75 to 90% of the country, the U.S. in 2006 basically put together this alliance, which is called the African, let's see if I can get it right, the African Union military presence or something like that in Somalia. And they invaded 22,000 troops. The impact of this is, again, I use the example of Afghanistan because it just keeps coming up and up again. So the U.S., you know, supports military in Afghanistan to turn away Taliban, whatever. All right, so what happens? Yes, Taliban withdraws. In the same way Al-Shabaab withdraws, supposedly, in principle today, Al-Shabaab doesn't control much of the country, less than 10%. But it's an illusion. You know, it's another one of those things where this foreign installed government controls the cities, and that the Al-Shabaab rebels have withdrawn to the countryside, but their presence is still there and their impact is considerable and they're waiting. And we know this because a week ago or 10 days ago, the U.S., there was a drone strike at a Al-Shabaab training camp in Somalia. It supposedly killed, U.S. drone strike, supposedly killed 150. And it is, at least one publication, The Guardian, referred to it as the largest casualty total from a U.S. military attack in the post-9/11 era. It's a lot of people that they killed, but I'm looking at it and I'm saying, wow, well, they haven't knocked out Al-Shabaab at all. So they knocked out this base. What typically happens after an incident like this? Al-Shabaab recruits more. So in the same way the Taliban are essentially waiting, you know, for a withdrawal of U.S. support from Afghanistan, Al-Shabaab is biding its time. In the meantime, it's engaged in a number of terrorist attacks. If anything, what has happened over the past, if you look, and now we're talking over a long period of time, really, more than 25 years, that Al-Shabaab, which was a really, in the beginning, insignificant grouping, Islamic fundamentalism, even in a country as conservative from a religious point of view as Somalia, had very little support. Today, it's got, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, it has significant support, and it's seen as an alternative to a foreign-imposed government. The presence of these troops, other African troops, Ethiopian, Kenyan, whatever, like any foreign occupation, is opposed. So, you know, once again, we've created this mess, and it begins. It it intensifies greatly with the 2006 Ethiopian-Kenyan-Ugandan invasion of Somalia. The most recent thing I would add here is you can see the situation has deteriorated because the United States has got Ethiopia to send another 4,000 troops into Somalia. So once again, we've destroyed, admittedly, what was a weak but still functioning state, and from that destroyed state, we see a generation now of instability, of radical Islamic fundamentalism. And the sense that I get is that this is what they wanted in the first place, a much weaker Somalia that foreign elements could dominate and do.
You know, that's the part that puzzles me out of all this, and there's a million different points to follow up on there, Rob, but that's the one that really gets me. It's page 222 of your Bible here, Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. He quotes a State Department flunky saying, well, you know, all we really wanted to do was take Sheikh Sharif down a peg. We didn't really want to destroy the Islamic Courts Union, but we just thought that, you know, they were a little too big for their britches and we wanted to bring them down. And then, of course, what happened was they kept Sheikh Sharif, right? After waging this entire war to overthrow the ICU, they kept its leader and only formed, he made a deal with Condoleezza Rice that he would be the new leader under the form that the U.S. and the U.N. had created of this transitional national government, or whatever, I forget the exact term for it that they called it.
That's what it was, yes, and then, the transitional national government.
Right, and then so that was when al-Shabaab said, well, screw you, old man, we'd rather keep fighting if you're going to be a sellout and a traitor to the Americans who did all this in the first place. But in other words, the State Department person admitted that this whole thing basically was for nothing, that they meant to keep the same guy in power all along anyway, which really raises the question. It really does. Why even bother when, you know, the ICU, maybe they had done a couple things. They closed a couple movie theaters or something that maybe got Christian Amanpour upset or something like that. But had they in any way, Rob, indicated that screw you, George Bush, we're not going to talk to you, we're not going to deal with you? Because I just can't believe that. I can't believe that anyone in the State Department saw whoever was in power in Somalia as anything but people that they can deal with. Of course. I mean, what's the ICU going to do other than welcome the Americans on bended knee when they come?
You know, when I look at Somalia, they're referred to as failed states, but they're really shattered states. And while, of course, in all of these states, there are certain domestic elements that one can look to, the foreign intervention seems to have been key. So again, you know, this is no mystery. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, where once again there's talk of a new NATO-led land assault on Libya.
Yeah, Hillary says stay forever, like Korea, Japan, and Germany.
Yes. And quite frankly, I've been reading stuff. I don't know that it's close to imploding, but what's going on in neighboring Ethiopia is very disturbing, too, and getting more and more tense. So one has to ask, well, what is happening that we have this whole series of failed states or destroyed states, you know, however you want to put it. And when we look at this, you know, I cannot help but look at the political economy of the region and how it works in failed states. Failed states are much easier to manipulate economically, politically. They're smaller. And so basically what we've done is U.S. policy has destroyed old dictatorships, or dictator-like governments. But these dictatorships, for whatever their problems were, I mean, think of Iraq, before the U.S. invasion. Absolutely not a particularly democratic place, but in terms of economic and social progress, one of the standard bearers of that in the Middle East, and one that could stand up to foreign oil companies. All right. In the case of Somalia, of course, it's different. It's not the resources so much as it is wanting to use the place geostrategically for whatever it is that the United States and here one should add, because they've really become a junior partner, France. The policies of the United States and France, not only in the Horn but of all of Africa, and so we're seeing over the, and it's been going on for some time now, a militarization, creation of drone bases, of advisors, special forces. You know, who knows where JSOC is? We find out later. We get hints of it. Of the operations that they're involved in. And at some point, one has to say, what's going on here? What's the essence of this? And the essence of this comes back to, from what I can tell, economic fundamentals, the protection or control of natural resources and the wealth of the continent for the use, once again, of multinational corporations, U.S.-based or whatever.
Plus make-work programs for the Army and for the industrialists that equip them.
Yes. And wherever they go, in the name of fighting terrorism, these forces have increased the terrorist threat. There are places that I watch pretty carefully. Mali, little Burkina Faso in Central Africa. And when one looks at these, I mean, you look at the situation in Mali. You can talk about Mali without talking about the collapse of Libya and the selling and the giving of arms to these Islamist groups. So in the name of fighting terrorism, U.S. policy in Africa has extended it, and no place is a more classic example of that than Somalia. Somalia, when I talk about the Middle East, we do a radio program here in the local public radio station in Boulder, KGNU, monthly, and goes on for an hour. And we refer to the U.S. Middle East policy, we just call it the train wreck. And now what we're seeing is the train wreck morphed onto Africa. U.S. policy in Africa is in trouble, and once again, there's the public policy, and then there's what's happening behind the scenes. So all this nonsense with the CIA, JSOC, AFRICOM, so much of which is secret, but which comes out in bits and pieces. You know, again, people like Scahill. There's another guy, another book I want to recommend to your readers. It's really outstanding. It's really short, too. This guy is emerging as quite an extraordinary researcher. His name is Nick Terse.
Oh, yeah.
Tomorrow's Battlefield.
He's the world's best, man. Yeah. I was wondering if you were going to say that.
Yeah. You know, if I was still teaching, this is the book I would use. I like Dirty Wars, but it's, you know, it's long. Kids don't read long books. This book says it all in, I don't know, 150, 160 pages. So that's what's happening, you know, throughout the content. I want to add something else here.
Sure.
Because, you know, I'm watching these in this kind of post-communist era that we're living in. So if you look, for example, we could take the case of Syria and the case of Somalia. Right? In some ways, they're different, but In one way, they're similar, i.e., they had in these countries what I would refer to as a legitimate opposition. All right? What the goals of the opposition were, classic goals, you know, greater democracy, more economic independence, whatever. These movements tended to be, they were a mix. There were secular elements in them, some religious elements, but they really were what the goal was progress in the traditional sense of the term. But in this current period, these legitimate oppositions are weak, and they don't have the political experience, they don't have the armed backing, whatever, and they're easily manipulated. So what happens in the case of Syria? These Islamic crazies from Saudi and Turkey or whatever come in, and within short period of time, they infiltrate and literally take over the movement. So movements that begin with what one might call from my perspective, an actually honorable goal in history, are consumed by this Islamicist movement. Same thing happened in Mali a couple of years ago. So we're seeing these patterns, and so these Islamicist movements become ways, not only do they piggyback onto legitimate democratic movements of social change, but they infiltrate and they destroy them. And that's essentially what happened in Somalia.
Yeah. I just think it couldn't be overstated how much of this is America's fault, and especially it pisses me off when so much of this is done in the name of this pretended Wolfowitz doctrine of exporting American Enlightenment principles to the world with force and giving them democracy good and hard, and yet they don't mean it. What they mean is mass murder and regime change in countries where we don't already control the dictator. That's all they mean, the bastards. But then they radicalize entire generation of people and push them right into the arms of the lunatic on the street corner, who is the only real enemy in the first place, who now all of a sudden is making sense to the average Joe over there because America set the whole damn region on fire. So there must be something to what the guy who was predicting that is saying, you know?
Well, I want to tell you, you know, we could turn it around. I could start interviewing you because I agree with you that, you know, the pretext, think of what the pretexts have become. They're so cynical and they're so fragile and superficial. So you know, you give the Wolfowitz version of it. We're exporting democracy and it's a wonderful thing, blah blah blah. What's the most recent one? Military intervention for humanitarian means, right? Which we saw in Libya, which we nearly saw very close to seeing in Syria in 2013. It plays, what I can say about it is, of course it plays well at home. It plays well at home for a population that has been denied access to what's really going on in the world. You know, what are we doing wrong? We're bringing them democracy. We're getting rid of the tyrants, blah, 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 blah. All right. Once you leave the borders of this country, nobody believes that nonsense. You know, it's seen for what it is. It's a cynical pretext, if you like. There's a really interesting scholar. His name is Mandami. I don't know if you come across him. He's really fine book on Rwanda, on Darfur, and places like that. But basically, he talks about humanitarian intervention. And he calls it the back door to U.S. military intervention in different parts of the world. So whether it's the Wolfowitz, if you like, pretext, or the Samantha Powers addition to it, we could call it. We're coming up with excuses, and this is, you know, in the old days it was simple. Oh, they're communists, whether they were or not. In the post-communist era, the United States has had to come up with a new pretext for intervention. And Wolfowitz and Samantha Powers have what they've provided is, if you like, the sugar coating, all right, on the cyanide pill. I was astounded, you know, before I'm retired now, by the way, but just before I retired, I mean, this is what you would hear, this stuff, at the Corbell School of International Studies where I was. Really people into humanitarian intervention, people who should know better and didn't. Well, maybe they did. I don't know. So you know, a lot of this, in many ways, Somalia is a model case from where I'm sitting, what not to do. It's also a model case for this this whole Obama doctrine, have the proxies fighting. It's a tragic model. Meanwhile, the country remains in shambles. Essentially, it's still a mess. And as soon as this aid drops off some, and it will, as it did in Afghanistan, you watch what happens. This whole thing is going to collapse again.
Yeah. Well, and
that's how it looks to me, anyhow.
Yeah, that's the one big point that hasn't been made on the show today, is about the famine that especially hit in 2011 and 12, where according to FuseNet, which was an American and British backed NGO that keeps track of this, the famine early warning system. And I point out that they're American and British backed because that makes it against their incentive to rat on U.S. foreign policy for the effects that it leaves. However, in this case, that certainly wasn't the point they were making, and I think they went ahead and told the truth the best they could anyway, it seemed like. And they said that 600,000 people had died in the famine in 2011 and 12, and that, of course, half of them were children under 5 years old, dying of starvation, basically in old makeshift refugee camps up and down the side of the highways. And, you know, the drought, of course, hit the entire Horn of Africa. And they had problems, of course, in Ethiopia and in Kenya and other places. But in Somalia, they had a war. And so all the old distribution networks of, you know, their very low-level market capitalism that they had there were completely broken.
Yes.
So any farmer who could even reap his crop, he didn't have a market to sell it. Nobody had any money to buy it. The whole thing completely broke down. 600,000 people died. And that's an Iraq war worth of casualties there at the hands of USA and the weather. Mm-hmm. But, you know, USA is an equal partner in that, it sounds like to me. Seems like.
Well, yeah, I mean, it all comes together. And then when you have some kind of natural calamity. So in East Africa, it's the famine. In West Africa, all these policies connect with the Ebola crisis. And when you look at the countries that were affected by Ebola crisis, there's a nice correlation between the rise of Ebola and countries that were forced to basically pretty much either weaken or defund their healthcare programs. Where you have a strong healthcare program in a country or a decent healthcare program, it's not likely that a disease like Ebola is going to spread.
Yeah.
So natural disasters phenomena combined with these political and social crises to create just horrors.
Yeah. Oh, let me ask you one more thing while I have you here, Rob. What about Burundi? I know that Burundi has been involved in the American-backed AU occupation of Somalia, and I know
they've
had a lot of political problems, and wherever there's a coup or a counter-coup or something, I suspect the CIA, and I also suspect that this is consequence from a previous American policy. I'm thinking possibly, like, for example, their occupation of Somalia. Can you shed some light on that at all?
Well, you know, Burundi, I can shed some light on it, yes. What we're looking at in Burundi and kind of the mirror image of what's going on in Rwanda is basically a political, a cultural, ethnic situation that's become politicized. Once again, in the case of Burundi, a Tutsi-run government with a Hutu majority, and that government has, as the government of Rwanda has, the support of the United States and France. in Burundi and Rwanda, you gotta look at the French connection too. That government is maintained in power as long as it plays along with U.S. and French African policy. It's really an explosive situation. You were talking about the high number of casualties that existed in Somalia as a result of the famine. Well, they don't talk about Burundi very much. In Burundi, there have been a series of clashes where the numbers of dead have been in the hundreds of thousands already. Looks like a place on the edge, and intensified by the fact that big military, but socioeconomic programs very weak, and economy that really hardly exists. Just a formula for terrible things that could happen. So it's worth watching. And calling for some kind of political solution which isn't, by the way, that impossible, to defuse that situation. Because when Burundi goes again, we're not just talking about the one place. We're really talking about the whole Great Lakes region. So Rwanda was the fuse for the events in the Congo. So first we have a genocide in Rwanda. Horrific genocide in Rwanda that spills over into the Congo. The government of the Congo collapses, Lumumba and all that. And then we have really one of the worst, most just painful periods in Africa. The number of people that died in the Congo, 1998, 2005, estimated to be somewhere, they use the famous 6 million figure. All right. So, if Burundi explodes, you can be sure that the spillover effect will affect that whole region. Mm-hmm. So,
by the way, Rob, you accidentally said Lumumba, but you meant to say Mobutu.
Oh, I meant to
correct.
Say Mobutu. Yeah. Yes. I knew what you meant, but I just wanted to clarify
for people listening.
Right. Of course, Mobutu, my good man. Yeah. No. All right. Well. Anyhow. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, man, it's a hell of a thing, and I guess, plenty of fodder for a lot more discussion, because as the American interventions and terror wars on both sides expand throughout the continent, it's just going to be the excuse for more and more intervention there, whether under Trump or Hillary, I think. So the U.S. Army has their way.
I'm afraid so. We're not looking at any...
And Americans don't care because it's Africa. So by all means, Army, go ahead and kill whoever you want and do whatever you want. That's basically going to be the attitude about this. We sort of have a history with the Africans here in America.
Yes. All right. Well, look, man, thank you. I hope it was useful for you.
And, it was very good. Appreciate it very much, Rob.
You take care. All right.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That is Rob Prince. He's at viewsfromleftfield.com. Hey, y'all. Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.